This is Backstory. I'm Peter Onuf.
I'm Ed Ayers.
And I'm Brian Ballow. Today we're bringing you a special Independence Day episode of our show. Peter, do we have another caller?
We sure do, Brian. Her name is Pam, and she's calling us from Saskatoon, Canada. Hello.
Well, actually, I live in Saskatoon. I'm a history professor at the University of Saskatchewan.
Wow.
But I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio.
So you're one of us.
Yes, so I'm one of you.
That explains that accent.
I'm a Canadian citizen, so I've got I have a dual personality.
So Fourth of July, do you celebrate the Fourth of July until noon?
Yeah, right, exactly. And then we celebrate Canada Day, which is on July 1st.
Well, how do they celebrate the 1st?
Yeah.
Well, it's the same way, actually.
No.
Fireworks?
And I don't want to say they're copying because that's a really bad...
Oh, that would be the wrong thing to say.
And plus,
Canada.
It's 3 days earlier, so they can't be copying.
No. Yeah, it's in honor of Canada Day, and when Canada became a confederation in 1867, a bit after when we became a country. And
Who's the we? I'm sorry.
Pardon me?
We? Oh, us.
The U.S.
Right. Okay.
So they celebrate it with fireworks as well. And I'm not sure if they play the 1812 Overture.
They eat hot dogs?
They eat hot dogs. Hey,
no, Pam,
burgers.
This is really...
So I have a question, guys. When did the 1812 Overture become the tradition for the 4th of July?
Yeah, I was interested in that, too, because I teach Russian history. And I thought, isn't that interesting?
Yeah, we're going to ask
you.
Well,
I think you've totally stumped the American history guys. So maybe the Canadian history gal can tell us.
No, I really don't know. And I tried to look into it a little bit online, and I couldn't find that out. I mean, I know that it's often connected with the Boston Pops as the first orchestra that started to play regularly, but I don't know why they...
I know about... My parents used to play in the National Symphony Orchestra, and they'd do this on the barge, and they'd have real cannons. And
Brian, how many times are you going to play this? My parents run the National Symphony Orchestra thing. I'm so tired.
We are hoping that some of our listeners will contact our website, backstoryradio.org, and answer this question for all four of us historians.
Well, Pam, I hope you enjoyed your July 4th.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
All right, music aficionados, this is your big chance to show us up. Drop in at backstoryradio.org and tell us when the 1812 Overture became the soundtrack to the 4th of July. The 76th correct answer will win you a very special limited edition recording. Brian Ballow sings the greatest hits of the National Symphony Orchestra.
Peter, you got another call for us?
I sure do, Brian. It's Tim from Hicksville, New York. Welcome to Backstory, Tim.
Thank you.
Tim, the 4th of July, what does it mean to you?
Oh, it's a bit of a conflict for me, actually. Mm. I'm a pastor in Hicksville,
and
I have a mainline denominational church there, and I struggle every 4th of July because there are some people who really want to celebrate it as a kind of a Christian holiday and turn over the Sunday morning worship service to it, and it's something makes me awful uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
So this is a problem for you because you feel like it excludes so many people, Tim?
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's also a theological problem for me because we have a couple of songs in our hymnal, like America the Beautiful, which are really praising America, not praising God.
Right. But that actually goes back in a big way to the 19th century, I think, to the time of the Second Great Awakening, when the rise of the Methodists and Baptists and evangelicals throughout the country, and that is the idea that good Americans were Christians, became pretty normal. I mean, the unusual generation is the founding generation because those folks were not particularly religious in our sense of the word.
But, Peter, I am confused because we think about the 20th century as secularizing many holidays that, in fact, are Christian holidays or religious holidays.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's odd that it would become more Christian as time goes on.
That's a great point, Brian, because the early celebration of 4th of July was really associated with celebrating Thomas Jefferson's role in channeling the American people in the Declaration. I mean, that's the great sacred scripture of the day, and that's not Christian.
So what kind of pressures do you face as a minister to incorporate this into the church service?
Well, some of it is nostalgia, you know, the way we always used to do it.
Yeah.
And how is that way? What stories do people tell? What do they tell you they used to do?
Oh, well, I hear stories about Sunday school mostly, when people who are maybe raised in the Depression and World War II era remember celebrating Flag Day and 4th of July and all sorts of other holidays that just encouraged their sense of group awareness and gave them a sense that they were pretty safe and life was going to be okay in spite of the trouble that they were in.
But there's not a religious element in that.
But, you know, especially in the rural areas, it was kind of like, you know, you went to the one building in town that could hold a lot of people to do some of your civil religion.
And that was the church.
Yeah, and that was often the church.
Yeah, no, that's a great point.
But it is possible to talk about a broad and inclusive patriotism that is not pro-war or anti-war. And
well, sure, and we have a couple of songs that sing things like, my country's skies are bluer than the ocean, but other lands have beautiful places too.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, those are not as popular as the real, you know.
Well, there's your mission, isn't it, Tim?
Yeah, you know, I've never actually invited a sermon before, but do you have a particular Independence Day sermon?
No, because I always do sermon from Scripture, and there's nothing in Scripture about America and very little about patriotism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, maybe here's a radical suggestion from a lapsed Christian. Wouldn't the very notion of love, which is central to the Christian gospel, be a way to deal with this?
Sure.
Okay, let's work out this sermon, shall we?
I'll expect it in the mail by
All right. Okay, Tim, it's been great talking with you, and I know we haven't solved your crisis, but it's, I think, a moment, the 4th of July, for people to be thoughtful about what it means to be an American, and that's something you can certainly ask them to do from the pulpit.
Well, certainly we can.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tim.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Well, if you guys really are looking for a 4th of July sermon, I think I've got something here that fits the bill. It's not strictly speaking a sermon, but rather a speech given on the occasion of the 4th by Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist and former slave, back in 1852. He delivered it up in Rochester, New York, where he lived at the time.
1852. So that's almost a decade before the beginning of the Civil War.
Well, yeah, but tensions were already running high all over the country. The Fugitive Slave Act had just passed, which decreed that Northerners had to help return runaway slaves and could be drafted by local constables to be part of posses. Uncle Tom's Cabin was written as a result of that. So all over the country, people were really thinking about slavery, abolitionism, and the tensions in the United States.
So Ed, are you just going to talk about this speech all day, or can we actually hear a little of it?
I thought you'd never ask, Peter. We're going to do a little time travel now, and we have a special guide for the trip, David Blight, a historian up at Yale who's written a whole book on the Douglass speech. And David is going to take us straight to the source, Rochester's Corinthian Hall, July 5th, 1852.
Friends of freedom, on this magnificent morning, the women of the Rochester Ladies Anti-Slavery Society welcome you here to commemorate the glorious Declaration of 1776.
Douglass gave this speech on the 5th of July, which had actually become a tradition in the state of New York, in particular in the African American community, a kind of subtle protest against the 4th of July at the same time black communities had been embracing it for years.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Frederick Douglass.
The hall held nearly 600 people. It was full. It was a speech that Douglass himself said he worked as hard on as any speech he ever crafted, and it certainly shows.
The fact is, ladies and gentlemen, the distance between this platform and the slave plantation from which I escaped is considerable, and the difficulties to be overcome in getting from the latter to the former are by no means slight.
The structure is brilliant. It's in many ways an oratorical symphony in three movements. The first movement, in a way, is the first several pages of the speech, where he welcomes the audience, he honors the founding fathers, he calls the 4th of July the American Passover. He directly quotes from the Declaration of Independence. He calls the Declaration of Independence the ring bolt and the sheet anchor of American liberty. He honors the founding.
The signers of the Declaration of Independence were brave men. They were great men, too. great enough to give frame to a great age.
And it's as though he's putting his audience pleasantly at ease with the celebration of American independence. And then, about a third of the way into the speech, the hammer comes down.
Fellow citizens, pardon me. Allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I, or those I represent, to do with your national independence?
He changes the pronouns. The 4th of July suddenly becomes yours, not mine, and he begins to rain the pronoun you down onto his audience.
The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine.
It's as though he has suddenly strapped his audience in their seats and won't let them move, and he rains down this litany of American hypocrisy about slavery.
I do not hesitate to declare with all my soul that America is false to the past, false to the present, and solemnly binds herself to be false to the future. Therefore, I will, in the name of humanity, which is outraged, in the name of liberty, which is fettered, in the name of the Constitution and the Bible, which are disregarded and trampled upon, dare to call in question and to denounce with all the emphasis I can command everything that serves to perpetuate slavery, the great sin and shame of America.
That spring of 52, early summer, Uncle Tom's Cabin was published to enormous readership. At the time Douglas gives this speech in Rochester, it's possible that half that audience already had a copy of Uncle Tom's Cabin. So this is an audience conditioned to some extent for this kind of critique of American hypocrisy. But I would also suggest that that audience, Douglas's own neighbors and friends, came to that speech that day not quite probably expecting how that hail was going to rain down on them.
What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer. A day that reveals to him more than all of the days in the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham.
But it's his point that you've invited black people here to sing for you. But we're not going to sing for you. We're going to make you hurt.
Your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery. Your prayers, hymns, sermons, and thanksgivings are to him mere bombast, fraud, and hypocrisy. A thin veil to cover up crimes which would disgrace a nation of savages.
Imagine being on the other end of that and thinking you were on his side when you walked in. But then, about two-thirds of the way through the speech, this portion comes to an end with a horrible image. It's right out of Jonathan Edwards and the Puritan sermons of the 18th century.
Be warned! A horrible reptile is coiled up in your nation's bosom. The venomous creature is nursing at the tender breast of your youthful republic. For the love of God, tear away and fling from you the hideous monster, and let the weight of 20 millions crush and destroy it forever.
And after that image, there's a transition. Probably he paused.
Now, citizens,
and this hailstorm of humiliation stops.
Notwithstanding the dark picture I have this day presented of the state of this nation, I do not despair of this country.
It's as though he picks them up and kind of wipes their brows off. And he says the principles of the Declaration, the principles of the Declaration of Independence are still there. They're like precious ore. They're forever. They're natural rights.
Encouragement from the Declaration of Independence and the great principles it contains.
And he says it's still not too late. America is young, it's youthful, it's malleable. It is still possible to save the country from itself. And then he ends with a poem that actually, I think, became a hymn that was written by William Lloyd Garrison called Godspeed, the Year of Jubilee.
The wide world o'er, God speed the day when human blood shall cease to flow. God speed the hour, the glorious hour, when none on earth shall exercise a lordly power.
So he ends on this note of, you know, the hopeful coming day of emancipation somehow, someday. But what that audience had experienced over probably an hour and a half is Douglas as an ironist at his best. Douglas, the kind of Jeremiadic prophet at his best. It's a speech that I think, frankly, is the rhetorical masterpiece of American abolitionism. And no one, frankly, appropriated the principles of the Declaration of Independence quite so forcefully as did abolitionists, particularly black abolitionists. The natural rights tradition, liberty, equality, the right of revolution, without those principles. And I think this is implicitly what Douglas is actually arguing in the 4th of July speech. Without those principles at the founding, where would blacks have ever looked for a future in America? They'd have had no future in America.
That was David Blight, and what I'd have to say is a pretty remarkable construction by our producers. David directs the Gilder Lehrman Center for the Study of Slavery, Resistance, and Abolition at Yale University, and he's the author of Frederick Douglass's Civil War, Keeping Faith in Jubilee. The speech was read by Fred Morsell. You can listen to it all on our website, backstoryradio.org.
You know, I got to say, guys, David talking about the way this speech was used to kind of give new meaning to the Declaration of Independence just blew me away.
It's very, very powerful.
What's interesting is Frederick Douglass was not the last African-American to ring those themes. Matter of fact, from the very first moments in which the Union Army went into the South in the Civil War and they met African-Americans, even people without the education and exposure to the world that Frederick Douglass had enjoyed knew how to speak that American vernacular. They would often turn to the words of the Declaration of Independence and the Founding Fathers for their claim on what it meant to be Americans. And some of the most beautiful documents I've ever read are the petitions from the freed people of the South to the Union parties and to the Republican parties and to the United States Army saying, all we ask is for our share of our patrimony to be full Americans.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Visit us online to continue this conversation. We're at backstoryradio.org. Thanks a lot for listening.
Backstory is produced by Tony Field, Rachel Quimby, and Catherine Moore. Our engineer is Jamal Milner. Gabby Alter composed our theme, and Backstory's executive producer is Andrew Windham.
Major production support for Backstory is provided by the David A. Harrison Fund for the President's Initiatives at the University of Virginia, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Perry Foundation Incorporated, Carrie Brown Epstein and the W.L. Lyons Brown Jr. Charitable Foundation, UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs, and an anonymous donor.
Oh, America, America.
Peter Onuf is the Thomas Jefferson Memorial Foundation Professor of History at the University of Virginia. Brian Ballow is an Associate Professor of History at the University of Virginia and UVA's Miller Center of Public Affairs. Ed Ayers is President and Professor of History at the University of Richmond. Backstory was created by Andrew Windham for VFH Radio at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities.
From sea to shine.